Well, increasingly, communities and cities are looking for ways to try and reduce energy use, to be more efficient about using our energy as part of the drive to reduce the environmental impacts and the global warming. And that requires a lot of localised action. We can't just leave it to the policymakers. We have to do something at the local level. And that's an area where our next guest has considerable experience. For environmentalists, of course, there's still some very big top-level fights like North America's tar and oil sands industry. The Canadian environmental activist and science broadcaster Dr. David Suzuki is here in Australia at the moment for a series of appearances, including talks at the Sydney Opera House and Melbourne University's series called For Thought, Hope for the Planet. David Suzuki joins us in our Melbourne studios. David, welcome to RM Breakfast.
Thank you. It's always great to be back in Australia.
At this point in your life, David, we know you're turning, I think you're about to turn 80, you're touring. What message do you bring on tour with you to Australia?
Well, the things are urgent, but once one seizes the moment, this crisis, in fact, there are huge opportunities. We've got to stop fighting, and all of this denial and skepticism about the reality of what scientists have been telling us for years, we've got to get past that and seize the moment. If any country realizes the reality of climate change and its impact, it's got to be Australia. I mean, talk about water shortages, talk about fires. You've had one of the greatest books about climate change, The Weather Makers, from Tim Flannery, coming out of Australia. You've got Clive Hamilton, who's written Requiem for a Species, saying, look, it's really late. We've got to act now. This is the moment. We've got an opportunity now to say, where are we going? And quite frankly, I've said for a number of years, when I come to Australia and see you've got an energy source that Canadians would kill for, called sunlight, and you hardly see any. I'm seeing more now, but for years, hardly ever see a solar panel on a home. You say, what's wrong with Australians? I don't get it. You've got this unlimited resource that is clean and it's plentiful. I mean, why isn't Australia leading the world in this technology to harvest it?
I think that has changed in recent times. I think there's been a dramatic take up in our cities anyway, at least, if not beyond, of rooftop solar, and also some communities now looking at trying to get off the grid and using solar and wind. There is more of this going on. And is that what you're finding, that with these big fights on climate change, environmental protection, and conversations happening at things like UN forums and at that level, the best way to go about them is at a local level. Communities, yeah. Individuals, I mean, you're here in Sydney, the city of Sydney, many other local councils, very active on energy use.
Absolutely. The C40s, these 40 cities, I think they're trying to increase it to C80s. These are cities around the world that are actually competing as well as cooperating to be the greenest cities in the world. The city I live in, Vancouver, has a town council now that is determined to be the greenest city in the world by 2020. Well, quite frankly, I doubt whether we'll make that, because so many other big cities are competing for this title. And, you know, I was in Sydney a few years ago, and I was blown away by what they're doing in Sydney to make the city a more livable place for humans, not automobiles, and having a commitment to get all of their energy within 100 kilometers of the city, trying to make it a place where you love to walk and meet other people rather than driving all the time. I was blown away by that. And that was a few years ago now.
But just using the term livability, David, is that missing the point? If we talked about making the city more livable, which is great, which is, as you just said there, makes it better for everyone. We walk more, we're healthier, there's more trees, all of those things. But is that going to save the planet? Isn't the point, should livability play second fiddle in a sense to better energy use? And they're not always going to be the same thing, are they?
Well, I think that we have to, I think livability has got to be a driving force, because we are at the center of the crisis. And if we don't have places that make more sense from the standpoint of our health and happiness, I don't see what else is going to drive it. But livability to me is to say, look, let's all sit down, whether we're in the corporate sector or whether we're in the environmental sector, let's sit down and say, what do we all agree on first? This is a thing that that I don't like is we're constantly fighting, but we haven't set what is the foundation of the way we're going to have to live. So I say to anyone, whether you're operating at the state level, the federal level, or at the city level, can we all agree that the most fundamental need every human being on the planet has got to be clean air? Mm. If you don't have air for 3 minutes, you're dead. If you have to breathe contaminated air, you're sick. So surely every society, every group must agree that protecting clean air is our highest priority as a species. And then, you know, you and I are 60 to 70% water by weight, and our body's leaking water. If you don't have water for 4 to 6 days, you're dead. If you have to breathe contaminated water, you're sick. So water is like air.
Sure.
And then, you know, you think of your all of your food was once alive. Most of it was grown in the soil. So protecting clean soil and other creatures has got to be at the highest priority. And
can I ask you about other creatures? Because I'm prompted to do this. I was at a friend's house on the weekend who had bees. They weren't her bees. She had them there. Someone else was the apiarist, is that right? And in fact, she's going to have to get rid of them because they started to sting her. But I know you're passionate about the protection of bees and the pollinators, and you encourage people to welcome bees in the yards. Why is that important?
If all the pollinators in the world disappeared, life as we know it on the planet, including us, would also disappear. Pollination is necessary for half of all plants in the world. Without pollination, we don't have the reproduction of trees and plants, and terrestrial ecosystems would collapse. Now, the idea that we're using chemical pesticides that to kill one or two species that are pests to us, but in doing so, we kill all insects, is the dumbest thing you can imagine. I mean, that would be like saying we'd like to eliminate crime in Melbourne. Well, let's kill everybody in Melbourne. That's one way to get rid of crime. Doesn't strike me as a very sensible thing to do. And yet with insects, we use these compounds that, the neonicotinoids that kill all insects, but that pollinators like bees are especially sensitive to. This just strikes me as madness. Without pollinators, we won't survive. It's as simple as that. So we've got to set the bottom lines and say what is our society, our life, built around the real things that keep us alive, healthy, and happy. And then we have to design ways of protecting those things and making a living. Too often now, the economy becomes the driving force of whatever we do. Oh, you know, we've had 10 years of a government in which the prime minister said, we can't do anything about reducing greenhouse gases. It'll destroy the economy. So that elevates the economy above the very atmosphere that keeps us alive. We can't do anything about our dependence on the atmosphere for our health and well-being, but the economy is a human construct. That's the thing that we can change. And yet now people bow down before the economy as if it's something that has emerged out of nature, and we've got to do everything we can to fit the economy and make sure it's happy and healthy. I think this is crazy.
Well, I mean, there's economic imperatives, I suppose, because everyone wants their quality of life to go forwards, not backwards. And then it's how you construct that or how you describe that, I suppose.
What is the quality of life?
Exactly.
What is the quality of life? I mean, it doesn't make sense. Is it about all the stuff? You know, we just haven't set our priorities straight.
Are you hopeful? Are you hopeful with the election of Justin Trudeau? I mean, he's progressive on the environment, but in government there will be pressures. There will be pressures about job creation and energy security and all those things.
Right now, we're celebrating because we've emerged from the darkness. I, quite frankly, had a one-way ticket booked to Mars if Mr. Harper was reelected. I just wanted out of the planet. This is a huge shift, and he took some big steps immediately that signaled the difference with the last regime. And the first thing he did was appoint equal numbers of women and men to cabinet. That, to me, is, as a father of four daughters who's always encouraged women to put their perspective into this. That was huge. And then he changed the name of the Department of the Environment to the Department of the Environment and Climate, elevating then climate as a part of the environment, as a fundamental and important issue. I mean, the changes have been immense. His problem is he's got 10 years of the Harper regime to undo. And that is not going to be easy.
Okay.
So, the honeymoon's going to run out within a year, I'm sure. And then we'll have hardball politics. But right now, I can't believe the change that's come over my country. And I look to Australia to do the same thing.
David Suzuki, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Dr. David Suzuki, and he's here in the country at the moment for a series of appearances at the Sydney Opera House Talks and also in Melbourne at Melbourne University's series For Thought, Hope for the Planet.